Well, it's my honor to be here. Of course, my assistant here cannot be here without Professor Nagner's invitation, so I will thank him first for the honor. And of course, the honor of spending a year, I'm counting my days, in 4 weeks I'll be leaving, so very sad, okay, I'm depressed too. But yet, over this last 10 months, I've been benefiting from a lot of your challenges and inspirations. And on that note, I have nothing but good to say about it, the consortium. And more important is the inspiration to change my academic research interests. The lecture I'm going to give today basically is a summary of my own intellectual journey in the last 10 months. Admissions. But before I start the research, I'm not so sure definition work, because I think Robert talked about, my first book is about the Song Yi Jing, which is basically anti-divination in many regards, because I've talked about Northern Song. Southern Song on is a different story. In other words, my beginning point is the questioning the validity of divination. But in the last 10 months of all the inspirations and discussion, working, the reading sessions, the colloquium, and so on and so forth, that inspired me to rethink my own positions. And today's lecture basically is some sort of like a self-criticism, not in the Mao's China sense, but in a more kind of a self-reflective way of understanding a position that I assumed early on, but have to change because of inspirations and challenges. The topic today, time, position, and action, the philosophy of divination of the Yi Jing, it's basically, I'm thinking about kind of three levels of argument. Number one is that, I think it's already, I'm just preaching to the choir, that there is the divination is not just about fortune telling. Divination is about philosophy, it's a philosophy. It's a practice. In other words, it's a combination of both a practice of understanding the future as well as a philosophical enterprise. I say it's a preaching to the choir because I know everyone in this room know about that. This is the topic of the consortium. But my job today is to kind of deepen this understanding, this philosophy of divination in this ancient Chinese text called Yi Jing, especially in the relationships of three major concepts, time or temporality, a position of space, and also this kind of intertwine between time and space that provide us this opportunity of thinking. And that is where prognostication, decision, and action comes in. And that is the three connections. It's through understanding these differences and the movement between time and space, temporality and spatiality, then we have this opportunity to take actions. Okay, let me start. Okay, first and foremost, for the last 10 months, I've been kind of like a question on my mind. If I were so critical about divination, how do I explain the ubiquity, the complexity, and there's so much time that human beings across the globe in engaging in divination, in fortune telling. I think we are now having this, watching this World Cup games. And you have seen many people doing divination, I mean, including using animals and sea, fishes, octopus to find out which, I mean, I've seen German television that octopus actually pick German team to win the World Cup. So in other words, divination is not alien. It's not something what we call the primitive society, people in primitive society do. It's actually people, we are doing it today. One can even push the case even further that stock market is a divinational, it's based on divination too. Will the stock market price up or down? We have to think about that too. And also in my case, I'm investing my retirement fund in bond market and also foreign currency. You have also predict what happened, the euro and US relationship, the currency value also too. So in other words, divination is, in other words, it's a part of human life throughout human history. I think that's something that we have to encounter, face with. And this is something, a dawning issue for me, is that how do we explain this ubiquity of a divination? I come up with at least four ways to understanding it. First and foremost is the most fundamental level of human life, is that we have a lot of hopes and fears. For example, I have hopes and fears now because I'm giving a talk that I don't know whether I can connect. I will know later on, at the end, if I can make it. So that hopes and fear, especially the hopes and fear that I encountered last night, is important because of its anticipation of failure, anticipation of uncertainty, and more importantly, unknown. You don't know what happened tomorrow, for example. And that actually gives rise to this urge to see what happened in the future, or at least anticipate the development that you can foresee. Or I think Lisa said, the invisible patterns of the events. Another thing is because of these hopes and fear, we want to kind of calm our mind. That's why I call it to alleviate anxiety. We have anxiety all the time. You look calm because you think that you understand something going on. You may be anxious. So in other words, there's a dynamic. The more anxious you are, the more calm you seek. So it is in this kind of dynamics, I think, that divination help, or a practice of understanding the future through understanding invisible relationship help. And this predicted future actually is not just the future per se, but also more important, give you a guidance to set an appropriate course of action by which you may attain your goal. Of course, you may never know you get a goal, so the hopes and fear come back. So this definition actually is an ongoing process. It's never one day, one year, one week event. Finally, I think the more important is through this process, by understanding your own hopes and fears, your uncertainty, the unknown, you probably know more about yourself, your own life. And I think this is the last point to reach an understanding of oneself. I think it's a more important kind of connection between divination and philosophy. The reason why I problematize these two, divination and philosophy, I think you know that there's a long-standing kind of bifurcation between science and religion, reasons and faith, or more importantly, modernity and superstitions. What I'm trying to do today is that I have to cross bifurcation and to try to come up with some sort of link between faith and reason, philosophy and religion, fate, particularly fate, and also reason. Okay, I refer to my colleague here, Lisa, because of this wonderful definition you gave. Actually, I've been searching for 10 months for a good one line or few sentences definition of divination. I found it there in two places. One is in Lisa's article in Early China. This is the first one I saw, and that's kind of my eyes actually pop. And then she literally, again, in the introduction, in the divination and prediction in early China and ancient Greece, I read, because it's important in this sentence, divination is a deliberate search for understanding of the hidden significance of events in the future, present, or past. It's a very complex sentence. How about I unpack it in the best I can do. First and foremost, the divination is maybe a practice of throwing yellow stocks, asking octopus to pick tame, and so on and so forth. But more important is actually is a search for understanding. In other words, the key term is that you want to understand what is going on. But the understanding is not just the visible, the apparent, what you can see. It's the hidden, the invisible. So in other words, the understanding is to understand what is behind the appearance. You can use many terms. You can use God. You can use the way in Taoism. Or you can use the sages' principle, the Li, for example. Whatever you want to say, but that is the invisible, the hidden pattern that is more important, central to this search for understanding. I find this definition the best in the last. It's understanding of in this invisible principle or connection of events in the future, present, or past. In English, it's always past, present, and future, but should reverse it. Because the definition is about the future, but this definition that we want to reach fortune telling, foretelling the future, actually is going backward to understand who you are today. And more important, even go further backward to understand who you were in the past. In other words, Lisa is an anthropologist by training too, she's actually using this argument about storytelling is part of our human life, that we want to weave together events into a narrative of past, present, and future. Even though we ask about the future, but it cannot have any answer unless we have this story. This we can call it a genealogy. We can call it a narrative. We can also call it as a saga. But it's important, that saga, because without a saga, we cannot know the future. In other words, I think in one of our reading sessions, we discussed about the meaning of time, especially present. And that's actually free present, and it's really concise, at least as our definition. We have the present of the past, present of the present, and then present of the future. So in other words, everything that we talk about, future, past, and present, is rooted here and now. And that is what divination means. Is we want to answer a question. So divination is about life. It's not about death. Even though about the future, but it actually ultimately rooted in our presentness, our today's situation. For me, then, in that way, we understand that way, that we can understand the definition as a conversation. I'm using Martin Buber's argument about I and thou. It is a kind of two-person dialogue, or better yet, you can use Gadamer's idea about hermeneutics. It's a two-person or two-party relationship between a person who asks questions based on the topic of inquiry and then an unknown, maybe a deity, in Chinese case, an ancestors, or in a Taoist way, maybe the way. Okay, whatever it may be, it's a conversation between one part and whole, between one voice and this totality. And this relationship that is important for us. So in other words, divination basically is to build a relationship between what is known and what is unknown, what is visible and invisible, what is present and what is going to happen. And this is going to unfold in a system of signs. It can be hexagram in today's talk. It can be stock markets, this ups and down. It can be numbers, if you're interested in empirical science, and so on and so forth. But these signs or symbols are important. Symbol give you some meaning, but you're always kind of a puzzle. In other words, it reveal, but at the same time, it also conceal. So it's this kind of a concealment of meaning that trigger our thought, our mind, about how to understand the something that we don't think of. In other words, divination have to catch us by surprise. It's not telling us what we want to know. It's to tell us what we don't want to know. And then suddenly you'll be a shock. This shock to the totality is something that I think is given us. You can call it religiosity from the perspective of a religion. You can call it a scientific review, revelation. No matter it may be, it's a self revelation. You tell you know something that beyond your control, and then this narrative have to be based on future, present, and past. And this free concept of present is important, underlying this narrative of time. This is the last two points I actually got it from Lisa. Yes, this divination actually does not have to have a deity. It may, but it might not. It does not have to be. It also does not necessarily involve magic. It can be magical too. So in other words, if we loosen up or broaden the definition of divination, we can include a lot of issues. I Ching is one prime example of that. Because I Ching, at the beginning, it starts with a conversation between a divider and ancestors. But it turned out from the early history of I Ching to the late history of I Ching, it changed. And it also, more importantly, as this goes on, I Ching actually becomes less and less magical, less and less depend on the divine entity, and actually require a lot more of individual agency or the reader to participate in this. So today, in the rest of my lecture, I would like to kind of go through the history to see how this I Ching that began as an oracle full of magic, full of this kind of transcendental aura, that become a text which is in our hands. You can read it the best way that Augustine say, pick up and read. Whenever you pick up the book, read it. Then you engage in divination. So you have two senses of divination in the whole, throughout the history of the I Ching. It could be a physical practice of getting an oracle, getting a hexagram by coins, by whatever means. It can also by picking up the I Ching and then open it up, as if just Augustine have done, open up the Bible. So on that note, this both way is a kind of accidental encounter with the uncertain future. And that is the root meaning, ultimately, the flourish meanings of the I Ching as a text of divination. Many of you must have read or have come across this Wilhelm Bay's, Ricker Wilhelm's and Carey Bay's translation. I use Wilhelm Bay because of Wilhelm first. Ricker Wilhelm first translated the I Ching into German, and then Carey Bates translated into English, and it became somewhat a standard text of the I Ching translation. The title I Ching actually make things difficult, but I will come back to that later on, because there's actually a story about how the I Ching become I Ching. But nonetheless, I'm not going to talk about this. It's not the key issue for me today. The key is that this I Ching, if you open it today, it's confusing because it has three parts: part A, part B, and part C. And for any reader, including myself at the beginning, it's really confusing. Part A is about the 64 hexagrams. Part B is a translation of a couple of 10 wings. Part C is the recurrence of the 64 hexagram plus some additional commentaries. Any reader will find out why you have this part A, B, and Z. Why not just part A and part B, hexagrams and commentary? Why you have A, hexagram, and then commentary, and then hexagram plus some commentaries? And then I think one of the scholars, I won't name, called this I Ching study as a discipline of the utmost confusion. It because of these structures of the William Bay translation. Actually, I would like to defend Ricker Wilhelms and Carey Bates, because this is what the I Ching looked like at the beginning: three texts and three times. One I Ching, three books, and three times. And actually, if you read Ricker Wilhelm carefully, he actually used this system because he learned from a Chinese scholar in Shandong. You know, and it's part of the late Qing tradition, the last dynasty traditions, which is actually date back to the 11th century, that have three sections. That three book is that you have the oracle. Sometime today it's called Zhou Yi, okay? The changes of the Zhou dynasty. I mean, rough timing, 1040 to 7 BCE. Is the original oracle, that is basically a divinational text or definition manual, like the oracle bones, something I have like this at the beginning. So you have these lines. And because it's a very long process of compilation, we don't know why they come together anyhow. I mean, all we know is that it came from this early China, the Sha, Shang, and the particular Zhou dynasty. We know that in this oracle, particularly in the original text, there's an emphasis on the Shang Zhou transition, especially hexagram 49 and 50, Ding and Ge. It talks about very concretely the change from the Shang dynasty to the Zhou dynasty. So on that note, we know that these oracle bones, this first layer of the I Ching text, Zhou Yi, came from at least compiled around middle of the Zhou dynasty, 700 BCE. But the issue is how this Zhou Yi became I Ching. It went through another process, the 10 wings. And this is the second part of the Wilhelm Bayes translation. The part B actually wants to show that the Zhou Yi could not be I Ching unless it ended with the 10 wings. I'll talk more about what the 10 wings are. Actually, it's a 7 commentarial material that divide into 10 pieces. So it's 7. But three of them actually, part one and part two, so thereby 10 wings. The wings actually mean, the Chinese original character actually is really the wing. The wings that is like a bird, the wings of the bird that help I Ching to fly. And this, in the I Ching that we have, or the I Ching we have, actually is the is a canonized text in 135 BCE in the Han Dynasty. So in other words, the I Ching is actually at least two texts combined, the Oracle and the Ten Wings. But to make the matter worse is that the combination actually changed, and that makes the case so complicated. And the I Ching as a canonical text became a contested text throughout the history of the Imperial China and late Imperial China. First and foremost, what are those things that we got from the oracles? From the oracles, what we know, for example, Yuan Heng Legion, for those who read the first hexagram, it's the hexagram Qian. There's actually other hexagram too, but in the first hexagram, we say Qian, Yuan Heng Legion. Some historian suggests that it may not necessarily four character Yuan Heng Legion, it may be just one line. That is to say, begin the offering, Yuan Heng, benefit to divine Legion. In the conventional reading, in our received reading now, is that is Yuan, one character, Heng, another character, Li, another character, and Zhen, Li. So the punctuation is that Yuan Heng Legion rather than Yuan Heng Legion is a phase. So the now is the understanding, is the beginning, success, benefits, and perseverance. And it become kind of, we find it again and again in the original oracles. You have sometimes Yuan Heng, sometimes Zhen, and so on and so forth, to encapsulate the prognostications of a divination. There are also other clear prognostications too, like Ji Xiong Hui Jiu, the auspicious, inauspicious, remorse, and mistakes. Auspicious, inauspicious is about the external circumstances that we have nothing to control of, but sometimes it's favorable, sometimes it's unfavorable. The remorse meaning is a mistake you make. It's something that is not supposed to occur, but you make a huge mistake to make it happen. So in other words, it's something that you it's a self-inflicted wound, if you want to say that. Mistake or the due is different. It's something that you can avoid. In other words, in some of the texts, Wu Jiu is supposed to be a problem in front of you, but by adopting some strategy, you can avoid it. So in other words, the due is actually is something that you can manage. Remorse, hui, is something that you put it to yourself unnecessarily. Auspicious, inauspicious is conditional. It's about external circumstances. There's also lines called the Li Shi Da Quan, is the beneficial to cross the great water. Actually, we discuss it later on. A hexagram is a sixth line. There's a one actually consists of two trigrams, lower trigram and upper trigram. Whenever you move from the lower trigram to upper trigram, you are crossing the great water. So this client say, when they say it is beneficial to cross the great waters, it doesn't necessarily physically mean that you take a plane to cross the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean. It may only literally mean you're moving from the lower trigram to the upper trigram. Okay. All right. Give me just to illustrate for those of you who participate in the two reading session I organized for the I Ching. I'm repeating myself. The hexagram Qian, originally just six lines, okay? Bottom line, hidden dragon, line two, an invisible dragon, line three, a hardworking, is from the bottom to the top, okay? Line one, line two, and then usually this is the end of the lower trigram, and then from the fourth one is the upper trigram, leaping dragon, flying dragon, and arrogant dragon. Just alone, we don't know much about the relationship. It is in the Ten Wings, however, they make sense. They try to make sense of this arrangement. That's why I think that the Ten Wings, without the Ten Wings, the Zhou Yi can never reach the I Ching in the sense of combining divination with philosophy and making divination as a living philosophy. This is the Shi Yi, the Ten Wings. Okay? Judgment, images, great commentary. The first three have two parts. So we make it a 10. So the words of text, sequence of hexagrams, discussion of trigrams, and miscellaneous notes on hexagrams. Okay. The first two, okay. Overall, how about that? Overall, I would say it's a summary. These 10 wings actually provide at least three functions, major functions for making the Zhouyi into Yi Jing. First is that it expands the divination into a more philosophical enterprise. And that is my key argument, because if you talk about the philosophy of divination in Zhouyi, we are talking about only the 10 wings, if you really want to say that. Because in the original oracle, we don't see that combination. It's more kind of fragmented, discussing about the auspiciousness, inauspiciousness, remorse, and so on and so forth. But more importantly, the 10 wings actually build a system. I'll go through it kind of slowly today. It also build a system of signs. And finally, and more importantly, most important of all, is to give an aura of authenticity and an authority to the text. Okay, first and foremost, the first three, okay, I highlight in red, judgment, image, and word of text. Word of text, by the way, is only for two hexagrams, Chen and Quan. It might be 64, we don't know. But it only exists two hexagrams, Chen and Quan. Judgment and images are for all 64 hexagrams. So in other words, this free text in many ways is defining what just we saw previously, these six lines that compose of one hexagram. What they say actually is each hexagram is a temporal spatial grid. It's a system. In other words, a hexagram can have to be understood spatially and temporally. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. On the one hand, the hexagram as a whole is the structure of time. And then the sixth line is the structure of space that connect the time and space together. And then this hexagram as a temporal and structural, temporal and spatial structure will allow us opportunity to reflect upon our life and thereby making decisions, critical decisions for our future. Okay, take for example, I'm the same hexagram, okay? The judgments and the images will tell you that line one is at the bottom. The sixth line is the top. So it already give you a sense that this is one totality. And then it will emphasize three and four because of the wording, a hardworking gentleman, a leaping dragon, that tell you that actually is what we call crossing the great water. It's a transition from the third and fourth. It's a transition from the lower trigram to the upper trigram. Especially the image, Xiang, we discussed the arrogant dragon. Say, why the arrogant dragon? When you have a fifth line that's flying, why the flying dragon will collapse into an arrogant dragon so quickly? It would say, because nothing is perfect. So in other words, this hexagram, each hexagram is not a perfect system by itself. It have to move. By the way, in the original standard, they have the number 9 assigned to this hexagram. So 9-1 is called the bottom line at 9. 9-2 is a 9-2 at 9. So each line have a number. And the 9 number here is show that it is all straight line, qian, strong, but at the same time, it's so matured, it have changed to its opposite, the yin line, a broken line. So in other words, each hexagram is already a map of change, depending on the situations. Okay. Added to that, there's another text called the trigram, discussion of trigrams. It's not that difficult because the 64 hexagram actually consists of 8 trigrams. It's a combination of 8 trigrams. But what the text show is that each trigram actually can be a series of symbols. It's like a boxes, so you can pick and choose. Okay, apple, orange, and then all this can go together. Qian is heaven, Quan is earth, Zhen is thunder, Sun is wood, and then Kan is water, Li is fire, Gen is mountain, Dui is stream, and so on and so forth. You have this soft, solid, up and down, all kind of in a system. They also show family relationship, like Qian is a father, okay. Quan is a mother. Zhen is usually an older son, and then Sun is the older daughter, and so on and so forth. It's also a family relationship. So on that note, 8 trigrams could be symbols of many, many things. It could be cosmological, it could be familial, it could be political, it could be geological, rock and stream, and so on and so forth. But it's important because it shows, for example, if you have 11 tai and then 12 pi, it's actually opposite. You have the qian at the top, quan at the bottom, and then it's the reverse. And it shows the relationship. One, if the qian is on the top and the quan is at the bottom, then it will become pi, obstruction, because they don't move. And then if you reverse it, because quan is at the top and then qian at the bottom, they have to change it in the reverse order. Thereby, it's much more peaceful and forceful. Same is true for Bo 23 and then 24 Fu. Only difference is that you have the top, this one, both of them have the quan, three broken lines, either at the top, either at the bottom, either at the top. But in the Bo, you have the gun, okay, one solid line and two broken lines. What it shows is that you think about that is a water underleaf mountain or a water underleaf rock. So if you're a gardener, you see water kind of sipping through underground under the rock. You can see eventually the rock is going to break. So that's what the symbol about peeling off. Okay. And then the reverse is that if you have the water at the top and then you have the zhen, the thunder at the bottom, then you have this kind of a powerful return, especially in the springtime, that you have this thunderstorm, that rain comes in. So you have this trigram can help you to understand the relationship. The last two hexagram is the water at the top, fire at the bottom. This is 63, and then 64 is a reverse, the fire at the top, and then water at the bottom. Okay, right. Qu Gua, the sixth sequence of hexagram and the miscellaneous notes of hexagram actually are also important as well, because what they tell us is that the 64 hexagram actually have a sequence. By the way, there are a lot of archaeological studies that show that different Yi Jing texts, there's a Ma Wang Dui, for example, seal text, that show that different sequence of the hexagrams. So this, in retrospect, sequence of hexagrams is important because it delineates the position of the 64 hexagram from the Qian at the beginning to the 30th. And the 31st start with the family and then all the way to the after completion and so on and so forth. What it says is that is to make the hexagram look more systematic, either in a circle or either in a square. And that is important because it provides the opportunity to mimic the whole universe. In the Han period, for example, in the later time, from 100, about 200 BCE to 200 CE, there's a concerted effort to make this hexagram correspond to the cosmological changes, like calendar, sunrise, sunset, moon, and so and the western wings and of moon, and so on and so forth. That is another issue is that not only the hexagram has sequence, they actually have specific meaning, correspond to each other. For example, if we usually talk about the minority have problems because they have powerless, but in the Yi Jing is the reverse. You have the weak actually is more powerful. If you have five yang line and then five solid line and one broken line, the broken line actually is the powerful line. So it's the reverse. The powerful is not by number. The power is your relationship in the setting. The same is true for in both cases, actually, the only slight change in this position. But the Lü, the 10 is actually much more auspicious because, Xiao Xu is more auspicious because the broken line is the fourth line. It crossed the water. The Lü is much more dangerous because the power is on the in a soft line that is only on the third. It's not yet crossing the water. You have also a relation between the Ge and Ding. These two hexagrams actually have caught the attention of many scholars, because they think that this is Ge, because the term Ding, okay, this Ding here, the Chinese character, actually connote a meaning of a cauldron, and that's why they think that this is somewhat like this. It's a depiction of the cauldrons. You can kind of imagine it. Wang Yidu in the 1920s, actually 30s, made a big case of it. So this is the leg of the cartoons, and then you have the free solid line is the body of the cartoons, and then the soft line is the 2 ear, the two handles of the cartoon. And then, of course, you have to cover it. Otherwise, you can remove the thing. So it is somewhat like a depiction of, okay, of course, you have to kind of forget about that. It's an angle that is a little bit shifting here. What is important for the Yi Jing is that the two have to be read together. In other words, that could not be Ding without Ge, and there's no Ge without Ding. So in other words, later on, the classical Chinese, when they talk about revolution, in modern Chinese it's called 革命, but in the in classical Chinese, 顶革, is a kind of a continuation of a change from a political change, the 革, into a political restoration and stabilizing the situation. But when you're stabilizing 顶, you're also already beginning a new process of 革. So two hexagrams have to read together. What this ten wing did is that if you indeed practice the divination, you find one hexagram, it's not the end of the story. You have to continue, expand it to other hexagrams. So the self-cultivation and self-reflection comes in. It's more a philosophizing situation that is to deepen your understanding of this of the situation that you're encountering. We discussed about this Wei Ji Ji Ji, the last two hexagrams already. This is actually one of the major points of the sequence of hexagrams. It makes clear that even though the Yi Jing's end with the 64, okay, the Wei Ji, okay, it is have to continue. And actually, it's the wisdom of the Yi Jing that it end in the incompletion. If the Yi Jing end with the 63, the completion, it was going to be a Hollywood movie storyline. But no, it cannot. The lover cannot be together. The king cannot fall in love with the queen, okay? The world have to be upside down. If it is too good, it must be wrong. So that is the ending. The ending is, one can say, is it like a book that without ending. What is supposed to end actually is the beginning of a new situation, and the later commentator actually make full use of it. That, like the open, like the pick up and read motives of Augustine, the Yi Jing have to read continuously. It's not just one time reading. The more you read, wherever you start, you can start with the first one, you can start with the 31st, and so on and so forth. When you start reading, you can go into all the other hexagrams. Eventually, you have to read it and reread it every day. The most important ten wings, one of the most important ten wings is the Xisi, the Greek commentary. To me, is that using a terminology of hermeneutic, it's sealed the text. And actually, it's clear because we know that Ma Wangdui sealed text actually is in other version that is circulating around the same time, with different sequence, with different ten wings, or slightly different ten wings. But why this one became later on the canonized text? The Greek commentary make it that way because it sealed it. In other words, after like a tomb, when you seal the tomb, nothing can put in. You know, in terms of the textual evolution, it is the end of it, in terms of process. You have three major items there. One is that the Greek commentaries emphasize that the Yi Jing is written by, or the Zhou Yi, whatever, is written by a genealogy of sages author, Fu Xi, King Wen, Duo of Zhou, and Confucius. We don't need to focus on who they represent, but at least we know. Since the book is written by a sage's author, it must be sage. It must have a kind of a sagely element. Then there's the aura of authenticity already there. Especially you invoke Confucius in the Greek commentary. It make an actually deliberate attempt to say the master said, mimicking the Analects, Zi Yue, to show that there's a relationship with the Confucian classics. Because of that, the Yi Jing become later on naturally becomes a Confucian canon. part of the Confucian canons. But there are two more main themes in the Greek commentary. One is the worries and contemplation. It emphasizes that the I Ching or the Zhou Yi started as in the Shangzhou transition. It's a time of great change. So much so that everyone, both the authors and the reader of the I Ching must worry. In other words, you cannot be complacent. The more worried you are, the better off you may be, because you can anticipate you can expect it, the unexpected. The other thing is, so I emphasize, is the totality, the vastness and the greatness of I Ching. It includes everything. We know that the I Ching actually is supposed to include the cosmology, numerology, politics, ethics, and self-cultivation. It's quite different from the oracle at the beginning. The oracle at the beginning is basically is serving two clusters of audience. One is the officials, the head of states, or the head of the small minority of the ruling elites. Like, there's some oracle talk about the giving birth of babies. There's also a hexagram. They talk about the marriage. In other words, there's a very focus on the top tiers of the political institution. But the Canaanite classic is open up. That's what this greatness and vastness mean. You have to be include a range of audience. From those who are interested in the cosmology to those who are only interested in the mundane daily life, the self-cultivation, for example. There's a hexagram, 618, about disease, gu. It could be originally meaning some sort of the disease because of the parental marriage and so on and so forth, that we don't know. But yet, that became later on an important hexagram about how to deal with health issues, how to understand the balance of the human body in order to reach a stable health conditions. So, in other words, this is the I Ching actually broadened the horizon, broadened the scope of the readers. What is interesting, I mean, since time, I will cut short on my history, is that. What is interesting after this sealing the text is that when the text is sealed, it begins a hermeneutical openness. In other words, the text is there now, you cannot touch it. Even though you have other texts like Ma Wangde, it cannot compete with that. But it doesn't mean that what is sealed is there. The other thing to do is that you read the text and then you comment on it. And that is the long-standing traditions of commentarial tradition of the I Ching from the 200s BCE all the way to 1905, even today. And this hermeneutical openness is important because it actually further and further emphasizing what we just saw a moment ago, this cosmology, humanology, and politics, over the centuries, they became the different aspects of the I Ching. I just give you a broad historical account, and then I will kind of wind down that way. In the 200 BCE to 220 CE, this early part of the Imperial China, basically I Ching paired with correlative cosmology. In the Tang period, 600, when the time that China is kind of related more closely with India, 600 to 900, it relates more to a one school of calling principle of meaning approach to the I Ching, which emphasize actually more philosophical discussions. This is the part that in the Tang period, the I Ching is more and more like an ordinary Confucian text. It's not much about divination anymore, not about oracle, it's about textual reading. The Song later on, 960 to 1279, a beginning of this, back to this, a little bit back to Han, and more kind of a cosmological studies. And more importantly, it's a revival of the oracle. So, in other words, there's a kind of a tug of war, or you can say a push and pull between philosophy on one side and divinity on the other side, sometimes too much on the philosophy side, sometimes too much on the divinity side, and then somehow over the year and over the century, a balance try to be rich between the two. And then in the end, the late Imperial China, you have a new kind of a commentary, Chen and Zhu commentary, that try to kind of balance these two. In the modern times, it's even more interesting that since because of modernity, the idea is to suppress the religions, Yijing is more and more moving towards philosophy. It began in the late 19th century as a book about linear progressions. And then later on, in the 1920s, it became no longer any more divination. It's only a text about the Shangzhou history through the kind of historicizations of the Yijing text. And then in the 30s and 40s, the Yijing coupled with the, because of the rise of communism in China, coupled with the historical materialism, especially discussing about the stages of development in China, from the feudal period, from the hunting and gathering period, to the feudal period, to the late imperial period, and then to the modern time. In the 1960s, even before the Cultural Revolution started, there was actually another coupling between Yijing and Marxism, discussion especially about dialectics. The yin and yang, the straight line and broken line, became symbols of the dialectical relationship between self and other, and even classes, bourgeoisie, proletariat. And then in the 80s and 90s is a revival of the Yijing back to the oracle. So this story actually kind of swing back and forth, especially in two ways. One is the oracle to tell us about the human psyche, the psychology, the cycle, reading the borrowing from the I Ching in the West, that bring the psychology into the reading of the Yijing. And then later on, also more recently, is to using the I Ching to discuss physics, DNA, medical sciences, and so on and so forth. So the I Ching today is more like a modern text of scientific. So from the history, even use superstitions and science as a metaphor. It began as a superstitious text, as an oracle. Today, it becomes a text about science and technology and psychology. Nonetheless, you want to reflect on this whole history of the Yijing studies, is that there's a call to attention. I mean, you are allowed to use this word, the call of attention of this Yijing text, the Oracle plus Ten Wings. There are a couple of calls to attention. Number one, this text tells us that human life is full of unexpected outcomes. It is actually conditioned by many, many factors. It can be time, it can be space, it can be many, many multiple actors and players in the field. Sometimes that we don't even know actions going on that affect us. So number one. Number two is that this life of complexity actually is full of hope, even though in many cases it's hopeless. In the hour of darkness, Yijing will tell us this is where it comes from, these worries and contemplation. In the hour of darkness, you show your true color, because it's there's always, how about using a kind of a expression, there's always a line around there's always a silvery line around the darkness. This you can say the Yijing is too naive or too optimistic, but at the same time, that is the attraction of this book, is that we be faced with uncertainty and also an unknown. We have to believe in something. Maybe the life is getting worse and worse, but yet there's always hope. In this regard, I don't know. I mean, as an Yijing person, I see darkness in the future because of the rise of nationalism and all this going on. I mean, in the 1990s, when I met with Rob, I think we were better off. The Cold War is ending, and then the New World Order may be becoming true. And then, of course, we have the Fukuyama, saying the end of history. Now we see that history hasn't ended. The history actually continue on with a darker chapter. I mean, with all these racial cleansing, I mean, going on in Iraq, for example. in this dark age, I'm using back in a way, I'm kind of remind all of us about why Wilhelm wrote, translated the I Ching in the 1910s. He translated I Ching under the gunshot of the Japanese invaders in Shandong, in Shandong, in the German colony in Shandong. He was literally hearing the bullet on his head and then writing the translations. What I'm saying that we might be getting back to that kind of a Wilhelm worries and contemplation, and he became a prophet of that in the 20s and 30s by going around in Germany speaking about the I Ching. At the same time, what the I Ching says is that even in the, we are approaching this, using Churchill, the gathering storm, I hope we should be continue to be optimistic about the nobility of humankind, and perhaps this is the this openness and duality of the I Ching shows that there's always hope in a seemingly hopeless situation. And on that note, I don't want to spoil your appetite for the dinner. I will end this way, and then anticipate questions and looking forward to your comments. Thank you.